Barbara Ray Venter has an interesting hobby, one that helps catch killers. She's a New Zealand-born genealogist who started out searching her own family tree from Scotland to Waipu and helping adoptees to find their birth parents. Police started calling her to help them solve cold cases using DNA from crime scenes and data from ancestry sites. And her pioneering techniques and pure determination led to the arrest of a suspect in the Golden State Killer case after 23 years. And that suspect is accused of at least 13 murders and multiple rapes. Barbara Ray Venter's work has landed her on Time magazine's list of the 100 most influential people of 2019. And she joins us now. Hello there, Barbara.
Well, hello. Lovely to talk to you.
Great to chat to you as well. Thank you so much for your time. You have degrees in biochemistry and psychology, and you're a retired patent lawyer, probably all the things you need to dive into the often fraught sort of family trees. But how did your New Zealand roots play a part in revving up your interest in genealogy?
Quite significantly, actually. My parents were living in the Bay of Islands, and unfortunately they were in a rather nasty car accident. My mother was killed in the accident, and my father was in the hospital in Whangarei for, I think it was about 2.5 months. So while my father was in the hospital, I was staying in their home in Kerikeri. And so, you know, paying bills and whatever, and I discover my father's mother, my paternal grandmother, I discover her birth certificate in my father's desk. And what was interesting is I knew that my mother had immigrated to New Zealand. She was born in England. But my father's side of the family, I thought that those grandparents were basically off the boat from Scotland. So here's my grandmother's birth certificate. And not only was she born in New Zealand, but her father was as well. And then I discovered on my father's side of the family, actually, they had emigrated my grandmother's maternal line. They had actually arrived in New Zealand in 1839, and the Ray family had arrived in 1851. So that was really kind of interesting, but the most fascinating was actually my paternal grandmother's line, because it turns out that they had been part of the expedition led by the Reverend Norman MacLeod, taking folks from the north of Scotland to Nova Scotia, and then 3 decades later to Waipu. And I never knew any of that. Mm. And as kids, we used to go surfing in Waipu Cove. And my dad never said, by the way, you met all kinds of folks who settled here.
Yeah, and it was...
So that was sort of what got me started. Yeah, it was fascinating.
An early indicator that family legend and genealogy don't always tell the same story, huh?
Well, I mean, we didn't really have any family legends. I guess we never talked about it. I mean, my mother talked about her family in Scotland, but my dad, either he didn't know the family history or he just wasn't interested. I don't know. We never heard that part of the story. So that was a big shock, discovering that I was like a fourth or fifth generation Kiwi when I had no idea.
Your family tree turned up another interesting thing. Your great uncle was a police officer.
Yes, so that was that's on my mother's side of the family. So, and in fact, it's kind of an interesting story because I started researching. So my mother's maiden name was Grant. And the Grants were from Inverness in Scotland. And at some point, so there were 4 brothers. The eldest brother, I think he ended up going to Singapore. And then there was another brother who went to England. And then my grandfather also, of course, went to England. So on the census records, my grandfather is listed as a spirit salesman, and in fact, in New Zealand, he was a publican. And so he was apparently a very wealthy man. I stayed with one of my cousins in the Newcastle area when I was visiting the UK 2-3 years ago. And so we went by all the different places that my various relatives had lived, according to the census records. And so we go to visit this one area where my grandfather had lived with his first wife, who died in childbirth. And so my cousin goes, wow, this is a really posh area. Your grandfather must have been very wealthy. Well, he was. But what was interesting is the brother who joined the London Metropolitan Police, and he was an older brother. He listed, I have his personnel records from the London Metropolitan Police, and he had been a rabbit catcher before he joined the police.
Amazing. So good at catching rabbits that decided to catch criminals instead. He was in the era of Jack the Ripper too. Well, I don't suppose you know if he worked on that case.
So and then I'm sort of hypothesizing, okay, so how did my grandfather, who was not, at the time he was living in this area in Newcastle, he was not a particularly old man at that point. I mean, I think he was maybe in his late 20s or early 30s. But my cousin was telling me that actually what that area was known for smuggling. And apparently there'd been a couple of ships that actually run aground there, and the whiskey barrels had kind of rolled into the beaches there. So I was starting to think that maybe my grandfather was a smuggler. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how I would ever figure that one out.
Okay. So you got interested anyway and became a volunteer known as a search angel. Can you tell us what that job involves?
Sure. So what sort of prompted my interest in doing that was actually when I started working on my own stuff and started using DNA, I started getting matches with people who were adopted. And one fellow in particular who was living in Kent, he somehow related to me through my paternal line. I have no idea how. We've never figured that out. And he had recently discovered that his father was not who he thought he was. And he had actually been watching the show Who Do You Think You Are? And he thought that sounded kind of fun, so he went online to order his birth certificate and couldn't find it. And sort of on a hunch, he then looked himself up under his mother's maiden name and discovered that actually he was a year older than he thought he was and had been born before his mother got married to his father. So we're still looking for his father. His mother's sister is still alive, but she won't tell him. All she'll tell him is that it was a Canadian serviceman who was apparently stationed in the UK during World War II. So anyway, so I wanted to try and help him with his quest, and I had absolutely no idea how to do that. So I went online and found this group, DNAadoption.org, and they offer online classes in teaching you how to use your DNA to find birth relatives. So that's actually how I learned how to do genetic genealogy, was through taking that class.
So how did you get involved in crime solving?
When they learned that I had a science background, they asked me if I would help teach the classes. And so I agreed to do that, and then I also was answering the webmail that came in. And there was an email that came in from a deputy, Peter Headley, in the San Bernardino, California Sheriff's Department Crimes Against Children detail. And what he wanted to know is if that technique that we are teaching to adoptees, could that be used to identify somebody who didn't know either who she is or where she was from? And this was a woman, she was using the name Lisa Jensen, it's not a real name. And she had been abducted when she was about 6 months old. And then she was recovered when she was about five. And the guy who was abducted her was a pedophile. And so she wanted to know who she was. And, of course, the police wanted to know where she came from because they wanted to try and track down whether there were, any other crimes that had been committed by the same person. So that was sort of how I got involved in doing this. So anyway, I told him yes, I thought the technique would work, and I volunteered to work on the project.
And were you able to have some success?
I did. So back then, the databases were not as big as they are now. So Ancestry right now, I think, has something like 20 million subscribers. Back then, it was only 1 million. So it took a little longer to do stuff than it does today. But it took, I think it was about a year and a half, and I was able to identify who her mother was. a woman called Denise Baudin. And it turned out that actually her grandfather is still alive. And so I had some names for who I thought the father was. But since the grandfather was alive, we figured, hey, we'll just ask him who Lisa's father is. And he says, Bob Evans. Well, Bob Evans was not one of the names that I'd come up with. And so on a hunch, the detectives in San Bernardino sent a picture of the guy who had abducted Lisa to the grandfather. And he said, yes, that's Bob Evans. So we now knew then how Lisa had been abducted. Her abductor was actually her mother's live-in boyfriend. And so from that, it turns out that this guy who was the abductor, he had actually been arrested and gone to prison in California for murdering his common-law wife, a woman called Yoon Son Jun. And he had dismembered her, wrapped her in plastic, tied it up with electrical tape, and then buried her in the basement of her house under 200 pounds of kitty litter. There were some similarities between that and the murders of four people in Allenstown, New Hampshire. Now, Denise Baudin, Lisa's mother, was from Manchester, New Hampshire. And those two places are about 20 minutes apart. And so the New Hampshire State Police then started looking at this guy who had been the abductor as possibly then the murderer of the Allenstown Four, as they were referred to. And they were able to connect all the dots. It turns out that he actually was an electrician. He had worked for the company that actually owned the property where these four bodies were found. And so long story short, they determined that he was in fact the murderer. So having identified Lisa's mother then led to that case being solved. We still didn't know who the people were, but we knew who the murderer was. And that story then got written up in a journal called Forensic Science, I think it is. Mm. And so that article was then published in, I think it was February of 2017, and Paul Holes, the fellow who had been working on the Golden State Killer case, saw that article and gave me a call and said he was impressed that I'd been able to identify who Lisa was, given that really for her all we had was her DNA. We didn't know anything else. And he asked me if I would be interested in working on one of his cold cases with him. So I said yes, and that was kind of the beginning of that.
Any reluctance? By the way, if you just tuned in, I'm speaking to Barbara Raventa, who's a Kiwi who helped catch the Golden State Killer with her work on DNA. Any reluctance to get involved in such a horrific case?
When I initially said yes, I didn't know which case it was. I didn't know that till we actually started working on it. But no, to me it was an interesting use of the technology. You know, I'd already used it for solving cases of unknown parentage for adoptees, and also actually for somebody who had been abandoned as a child. He was a foundling. So I'd also helped him find his parents. So I'd been doing it in other contexts. And so, I just thought it was an interesting opportunity to see if this would work for solving a case like that.
So how did you begin?
How did I begin?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing we had to do, obviously, was get a hold of some DNA. And as you had indicated in your introduction, the Golden State Killer was actually responsible for over 50 rapes and 13 homicides, and some of those were rape homicides. So what we had to do was track down a good source of DNA. So what we were able to do is obtain a semen sample from Ventura County, which was one of the jurisdictions where there'd been a rape homicide. And we were very fortunate because the medical examiner in Ventura, what he had done is he had a system where he always took two samples, and he froze one and never used it for anything else, and then he did all of his tests and whatever he was going to do on the other sample. So we were able to get a totally pristine sample that had been frozen for, 25, 30 years, but it had never been, you know, thought out or anything done to it. So it was a totally pristine sample. It was wonderful. And so we were able to get a very good DNA profile from that. And then what you do with the DNA is, at the time that I was working on this case, there was only one place to actually look for matches, and that was a site called GEDmatch, which is a third-party site where people who've tested at any company, they can take their DNA profile, download it from wherever they tested, and then they upload it to GEDmatch and then look to see if, you know, if you're doing family history research, to look to see if you've got any cousins or anybody showing up as matches to your DNA. So this was then doing basically the same thing, looking for people who were related to the crime scene DNA. And then from there, what you do is you build family trees. And because these people are sharing DNA, what you do is you look for common ancestors. And what you know at that point is that if you have the common ancestors, that the person you're looking for has to be a descendant of those common ancestors. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have a second cousin match, second cousins share great-grandparents. So if you have a couple of different people who both have a second cousin match and they are sharing a pair of great-grandparents, you know those are your common ancestors and that the person you're looking for descends from those great-grandparents. Uh-huh. So then you just build down. So we do what we call reverse tree building. And so we then build down from those great-grandparents and look for somebody who meets the criteria that we are looking for. So, for example, with the Golden State Killer, he was active in Northern California. We figured he at least lived in California, probably Northern California, maybe even Contra Costa County, which is where Paul Holes was, and where a number of the initial crimes were committed.
Yeah.
We knew that the rapes had started in about 1976, so we figured, well, he's probably born in 1956 or earlier. From some of the rape victims, we knew he was fairly tall and had blonde hair. And then I had run the DNA analysis actually on the GEDmatch site for eye color, and that the DNA said that he most likely had blue eyes. So that's sort of the little profile that we've developed. So then I go through, I build the trees, build down to the time period when the person would have been born. At that point, we ended up with a list of 9 men who had all those criteria. So they lived in Northern California. They were born in 1956 or earlier. I don't know if we looked at hair color at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think we mainly looked at the geography and the age. And we actually
and the common ancestor, right? Age, geography. Age, geography, and the common ancestor. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Exactly. So at that point, our original match that we'd had was like a third cousin or maybe even a fourth cousin match. And so at that point, we decided, well, you know, we probably should do a little bit of a reality check here. So we approached a couple of people about doing consensual testing. So I was not involved in that, but I understand what the detectives did as they went out. They talked to a couple of people, said, you know, we're trying to rule out family members as potentially being, I don't know if they said it was the Golden State Killer or not, but you know, they had a crime scene situation. They were trying to rule out family members and would this person be willing to test. And so this one particular woman who agreed, she turned out to be a second cousin. So now we're back to the great-grandparents. So we know that one of her pairs of great-grandparents is who we're looking for, and we're already you know, in a particular part of the tree. More significantly, she also had an X chromosome match with our crime scene DNA. And that was significant because men only have one X chromosome that they get from their mothers. So we suddenly knew that that was the maternal line that we were looking at. And I was also then able to eliminate 3 more of the men from the list who could not possibly have an X chromosome match based on the family tree that we had. So at that point, we're down to 6. And at that point, we decided to see if any of these folks had blue eyes. And so the California driver's license records were pulled on these 6 men, and only one had blue eyes.
Wow.
That was Joseph D'Angelo.
Joseph D'Angelo. D'Angelo, an Italian name, and that was some surprise to the detectives involved.
It was to the detectives, but not to me, because his DNA was saying that he was 40% Southern European. And unfortunately, that part of his tree we were not really able to work on. So we actually only worked on the half of the tree, which was more Western European, UK-type ancestry. Because when we started to try and there were a lot of matches also from people who had Italian background, which was also confirming that that was probably correct. And, of course, that then turned out to be the paternal line. But, unfortunately, they were recent immigrants to New York from Italy. And so we would start building out a tree, and basically it would, you know, in 2 to 3 generations, would be heading back to Italy. Mm. And none of us read Italian. We were not familiar with the Italian records. And on top of that, even though the Italian records, a lot of them had actually been scanned, they hadn't been digitized. And so that would have meant doing manual research in a foreign language in records you have no clue what they are. That just wasn't going to happen. So we actually only used the maternal line to solve this case.
Do you remember the moment where it all clicked and you came up with a name?
Well, he'd actually been sort of showing up as being a potential suspect. We found, I mean, obviously all of the stuff that we're finding is way before the internet. And one of the things that we found was a newspaper article about him being arrested for shoplifting in Citrus Heights, which is actually the area where a lot of the rapes took place. Citrus Heights is a suburb in Sacramento. And he'd been shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. And there were a number of folks that actually had commented that their dogs didn't seem to react to the fact that he was there. So I don't know what's in the dog repellent, but apparently it caused the dogs not to respond to the presence of an intruder. And so anyway, so he was arrested for that. And this is when he was actually a police officer in Auburn, which is up the I-80 interstate, which actually goes straight into Sacramento. And so when you look to the map, it was just a straight shot. He lived in Auburn. And I actually sent an email when we found that little article. I actually sent an email to Paul Holes and Steve Kramer, the FBI agent who was working on this case. And I said, is this guy being ruled out? Paul actually went and talked to his former boss, because, of course, he got fired after this. He was kind of peeking out there as being somebody of interest, even before we got to the point of narrowing down. And, of course, it was exciting when he'd been ended up in my list of six as to whether or not he would turn out to be the right person, and, of course, he did.
Yeah. So a tremendous sense of satisfaction for you when that happened, or just moving on to the next job?
Well, of course it was exciting. And the thing is, you know, because I'm a civilian, you know, so I give them the name. I got a phone call, so I sent an email to Steve and Paul saying this is who I think it is. And so the next morning I get a phone call from Steve Kramer, and he goes, how sure are you? And I said, well, as long as we've now got everybody in our tree, you know, we've built it down and we've got all the descendants, I'm sure. And so then I don't hear anything. And of course, they're out busy putting this guy into surveillance and trying to get what we call trash DNA or surreptitious DNA that they can compare with the crime scene DNA in CODIS, which is the FBI database. And then I get a phone call saying that they've, you know, got their results back, and it's, you know, one in whatever quadrillions chance that it's anybody else. So that was cool.
Yeah, really cool. Have you ever met any of his victims or family members of the victims?
I've had several people come up to me who know victims. So I had one woman, this was very moving. I was giving a presentation down in Burbank, down near Los Angeles, and there was a woman came up to me. She was just in tears. She could barely speak. And she just said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And it turned out that she had three friends who were his rape victims. And then I had a gentleman come up to me after one of my presentations, and he had been a boy of about, I think he said he was like 8 or 10 years old, living in the area when the East Area Rapist was active up in Citrus Heights. And he said at night, he apparently had a sliding glass door on his bedroom, and that was how this guy used to get in quite often, was through a sliding glass door. So this little kid would, you know, stuff something in the runner so that the door couldn't be opened, and he'd go to bed with his BB gun. How sad is that?
Yeah, it's an incredible story. You going to stick with it? Barbara, the world needs you.
Well, I've actually solved another 25 cases.
Oh, wow. Tell me there's a book or even a movie coming out about you.
Well, I have lots of people asking me about doing that, but I haven't done anything yet. Well, we'll see. I get lots of, you know, emails from Netflix and you know, various other folks. And then, yeah, I've had a lot of people approach me about doing a book. I don't know. We'll see.
And as I mentioned, you were named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. I think you sort of brushed that one off fairly quickly as well, didn't you?
Well, it was really a lovely surprise. Certainly nothing that I was expecting. It wasn't even on my horizon. And it's funny because I get so many emails from, you know, various news-type agencies. You know, so I see this email come in from Time Magazine, and I actually almost didn't open it. And I thought, oh, well, I should probably see what Time wants and open it up and find out that, yeah, that I've been nominated as the Time's 100 Most Influential. I really and truly was stunned. So not anything I was expecting.
Thanks so much for giving us some of your very valuable time this afternoon.
Well, you're very welcome.
Nice to chat to you. Barbara Ray Venter, the Kiwi who helped catch the Golden State Killer.